Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The headquarters building for the Kansas City, Missouri school system is going up for sale. The superintendent figures that'll save almost $1 million a year. It's not going to be quite enough, though. So today, what happens that a city has to shut down almost half its schools? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to strengthen America by empowering more young people to achieve educational success beyond high school.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday, today the 11th of March, and it is good to have you with us. The Board of Education in Kansas City, Missouri, took a vote last night on how to save their city's long-troubled school system. It was close, but by the end of the evening, a plan to shut down 28 of the district's 61 schools and lay off 700 people did pass. The vote was 5-4. The district says the plan should cut $50 million from the budget. Barbara Shelley is a columnist for the Kansas City Star. She's been writing about schools there and the city itself for quite a while now. Barbara, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
What's the reaction in town today after this announcement?
Well, I think you have two different reactions. You have a reaction from people that are going to be directly affected. That's the families and the teachers and the students, and there's a lot of anguish in that group. You have another reaction from, I would say, business types and people that see this as a hope that a smaller, more streamlined school district will mean better performance and a better academic potential for the district.
That's actually what John Covington, the superintendent there, said. Lay out his rationale for us on that one, would you?
Well, his rationale is that he came here in July and saw a district that was seriously underperforming academically and also was going bankrupt fairly quickly. He thinks the district will be out of money next year. So his rationale was to take a look at the buildings, and he saw high schools operating at 40% capacity, elementary schools at 60% capacity, and he said, we can't sustain this.
40 and 60% capacity, so this could not possibly have come as a surprise to anybody.
Oh, no. Superintendents have proposed closing for years. It's just that the board has always whiffed on it. You know, there's always been a lot of reaction, and the board's haven't been able to do it.
Kansas City has had kind of a troubled history with the school district. Give us just a little bit of perspective, would you?
Kansas City in the mid-80s became the site of what became the most expensive desegregation effort that anyone knows that went on in the United States. And the rationale is, let's build a first-rate school district. Let's offer really cutting-edge, great programs. And that's how we'll desegregate, by making these schools so attractive that people will come in from the suburbs to use them.
And it just didn't go out so well, or what happened?
It had some success in the beginning, and then the Supreme Court, you know, basically cut the program off the knees. But what has really happened over the years is a, I would say, chronic mismanagement and lack of focus on the core mission of a school district, which is teaching and learning.
Now that the superintendent has convinced the school board to close these schools, what's his plan to fix things?
Well, his plan is, you know, once he shores up the finances, he's talking about better professional development, pay for performance, the kind of things that we're hearing out of the education department right now, that's going to have teachers really be stakeholders in their students' educations.
Your kids, I'm told, are out of the Kansas City schools now, but you've been around for a while. What's your take? Is this going to work?
Yes. it could work. We have great kids in Kansas City. You know, this superintendent, John Covington, people have a lot of hope for him. Oh, we've had a parade of superintendents through here, and Dr. Covington has a good track record. He's brought in what appears to be a very sharp executive team that knows what they're doing.
In the short term, though, in the meanwhile, Kansas City kids come this fall are going to have to find new schools.
Well, they are, and this isn't the first time they've reconfigured buildings and reconfigured grades, and you know, a lot of families have a bit of fatigue about these constant changes, but there's going to be another round.
Barb Shelley, she writes a column for the Kansas City Star. Barb, thanks a lot.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Far away from Kansas City today, traders on Wall Street were pretty much minding their own business. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The mismatch between how much stuff we buy from overseas and how much less stuff we sell abroad got smaller in January. Today's report on the federal trade deficit was smaller overall, actually. There simply isn't as much trade happening after the Great Recession. The president took that report as a cue to make a pitch for his trade policy this morning. He's promising to double American exports with tough enforcement of our trade agreements. He figures that'll help create some of the new jobs that the economy so desperately needs. But Marketplace's John Dimsdale reminds us that nothing in Washington comes without compromise.
President Obama said export promotion is one path out of the economic doldrums.
In a time when millions of Americans are out of work, boosting our exports is a short-term imperative.
To sell American products overseas, the president is backing financing for the Export-Import Bank, which lends money to potential exporters. But last year, the Ex-Im Bank backed the exports of oil, gas, and mining technology and power plants. That represents a tripling of the pollution from the previous year's underwriting. Doug Norlin with Pacific Environment says these export policies are undermining Obama's goal of cutting greenhouse gas pollution.
The Export-Import Bank is operating at cross purposes, financing a skyrocketing portfolio of fossil fuel projects.
But the chairman of the Ex-Im Bank, Fred Hochberg, says you can't double exports and grow jobs if you only promote alternative energy projects.
No, there's not nearly enough of those clean energy exports to do that.
He says the Ex-Im Bank is supporting more solar power, too. But Pacific Environment's Doug Norlin says the U.S. has been urging other countries to stop subsidizing oil, coal, and gas.
And if we don't do it ourselves, and in fact if we do the opposite and finance an ever-increasing amount of fossil fuel projects, we will appear hypocritical and we won't succeed in our climate change goals.
In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Microsoft founder Bill Gates found himself in an unusual situation this morning. For the first time in what seems like forever, actually, Gates is number two on the list of the world's richest people. Forbes magazine says Mexican businessman Carlos Slim is number one. He's got a net worth north of $53 billion, ahead of Gates by a couple of hundred million. It's the first time in almost 20 years that somebody outside the United States has topped that list. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Carlos Slim has his fingers in just about every pie in Mexico. Luisa Kroll is senior editor at Forbes and co-edits their billionaires list.
In terms of Mexico, he is it.
Carlos Slim owns grocery stores, banks, restaurants, and controls the mobile phone industry in Mexico. In this country, Slim owns about a quarter of the New York Times. Kroll says Slim doesn't flaunt his wealth, often eating at Sanborn's, a chain of diners he owns. It's like Bill Gates eating at Denny's every day.
Being the richest guy in Mexico, you don't necessarily want to be living such a high lifestyle.
Back in 2007, Slim was making about $27 million each day, while most Mexicans survived on $2 a day. Critics call him a robber baron and compare him to John D. Rockefeller. Professor George Grayson at the College of William and Mary in Virginia says monopolists like Slim have been unhealthy for Mexico's growth.
If you compare Mexico to the human body, its arteries are just clogged, and that clogging is done by monopolies and oligopolies, of which Slim has one of the largest.
He says Slim's dominance distorts the market, making it harder for other entrepreneurs to climb the ladder. But another developing nation could soon dominate the who's who of world wealth. According to Forbes, there are 64 billionaires in China, more than any place outside the U.S. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
International aviation isn't doing so badly as the world economy slowly bounces back. The industry's main lobbying group said today that total losses are going to be about $3 billion. A lot of money, but half of earlier guesses. American carriers are doing their part to be profitable. A new rule from the Department of Transportation goes into effect next month. It'll slap huge fines on airlines that keep passengers waiting on planes for more than 3 hours without giving them a chance to get off. It sounds great, obviously, but airlines say it's going to have all kinds of costly consequences for passengers. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more.
Airlines that keep passengers on the runway for longer than 3 hours will face fines of more than $27,000 per person. On a big plane, that could add up to millions. David Castlevetter is with the Air Transport Association, which represents airlines. He says carriers will just cancel flights if there's a bad storm coming or a really long line for takeoff.
Rather than take the chance of a pretty hefty fine, carriers will proactively cancel those flights.
The Department of Transportation came up with the fines in reaction to a spate of cases a few years ago when some passengers were stuck on planes for as long as 11 hours. Industry consultant Mike Boyd says the airlines are usually not to blame for the delays.
This makes DOT look like they're really standing up for the consumer. But when we do have airplanes stuck, 90% of the time, it's because we have an air traffic control system that the Department of Transportation hasn't upgraded in the last 30 years.
Airlines like Delta and JetBlue are asking for exemptions at congested airports like New York's JFK. But aviation analyst Richard Abilafia says airlines have options.
Going back to the gate or deploying stairs and getting them off the plane and back to the terminal. And that does create disruptions in the schedule. And, of course, that means higher operating costs.
Abilafia says canceling a flight is also expensive. So don't rule out that 2-hour and 59-minute wait on the tarmac just yet. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
I'm really more of a Project Runway guy than an America's Next Top Model guy, but I'm reliably told that on last night's season premiere of ANTM, there was a plus-size model among the finalists. It's not the first time that's happened, but it is the most recent example of the growing trend. Magazines are hiring plus-size columnists. They're putting more normal-looking models on their covers, and the industry is finally waking up to the size of the plus-size market. But some professional women say they have been left behind, as Sally Herships reports.
I went shopping with my friend Andrea recently. We hit some Brooklyn boutiques to check out the new spring clothes. We saw some sophisticated dresses and colorful cardigans, but there was nothing for Andrea.
What do you think of this sweater?
It's nice. It's nice. I don't know if it would fit across all of the parts of my body.
Andrea is a size 18. That makes her what's known as plus size. There was nothing in the store that would fit her. She says that happens most of the time.
It's incredibly frustrating. I have money in my pocket. I want to spend it, and nobody wants to take it.
Deb Holland knows the feeling. She's a marketing executive in Dallas. Her clients are Fortune 100 companies. When she makes a presentation, she needs to look the part. That's not easy when you wear a size 26. She says only three designers make clothes she can wear for business.
And I own everything in every one of those three lines, and I don't have enough clothes to make it on it through a two-week business trip.
Holland says that the lack of large-size professional clothes is more than a question of fashion. It can cause real problems at work. Early in her career, Holland worked at an ad agency.
We got a new president, and he walked in one day, and he fired me because he said my wardrobe just wasn't up to his standards.
There are many casual options for women like Holland. Lots of tops and leggings and sweats at stores like Lane Bryant. In fact, women who wear larger sizes spent $18.6 billion on apparel in 2008. But Holland still has to have her business wardrobe tailored or custom made, and that's expensive, hundreds of dollars for suits and blouses.
It shouldn't be so hard to buy a long sleeve, button down, white, good quality shirt. It just shouldn't.
So why is it so hard? There are a lot of theories out there. One of the most popular is that high-priced designers don't want to see their creations in larger sizes. Another is that a size 20 dress just doesn't look good on the rack. I wanted to ask Ann Taylor if that was behind the retailer's decision to pull its plus sizes from stores and sell them only online instead. The store declined our request for an interview, but retail analyst Madison Riley says he doesn't think size is the issue.
I don't see a stigma attached to it. Retailers are very adept in this country. It's one of the best retail markets in the world. If a retailer sees demand, they'll pursue it.
Over a third of American women are overweight enough to be classified as obese. But Riley says
the bulk of America, American women, is still very much in what is we'd call a missy size range, you know, that 8 to 16.
Which means shoppers who wear much bigger sizes are still a small group. And that group is divided into even smaller groups because different women want different clothes. Some, like Deb Holland, want professional clothes, but others want sundresses or maybe jeans. Riley says for big retailers, selling to those narrow markets doesn't make economic sense.
And the inventory commitment you'd need to pursue it is just not in line with the revenue. And that's where I think the rub comes.
Some specialty retailers are finding profit in dressing plus-size professional women. Talbot's clothing chain stocks bigger sizes in 200 stores. Lizanne Kindler is Senior Vice President of Merchandising for Talbot's. She says the plus-size customer is worth pursuing.
She tends to focus on full-price shopping. She tends to spend more than the average customer when she's in the store. She tends to buy more items and more expensive items.
Wow, this sounds like the dream customer.
It is, which is why we believe that it's a growth initiative for us.
Retail analyst Madison Riley agrees. While shoppers like Deb Holland don't have many options now, if you'll pardon the pun, the future of plus-size fashion is growing. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up, the harder-than-you-think business of music for video games.
There's a significant difference when you get to video games where you're still trying to tell the story, but the player's actually in control of how the story's playing out.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 0.4% today, 44 points, closed at 10,611. The NASDAQ nudged up 0.4 as well, closed up 9 points, 2368. The S&P 500 skipped up, wait for it, 0.4%, 4 points, ended at 1,150. Investors bought Citigroup CEO Vikram Pandit's line that his bank is going to start being profitable. Shares rose more than 5.5% today. Regional banks also rose on that news. KeyCorp cranked 4% higher. Zions Bank Corp sipped up 4.5% today. Speculation that a health care reform bill is not going to pass Congress anytime soon gave some health care related stocks a shot in the arm. Coventry Health blipped up 3.3% today. Humana, Cigna, and WellPoint all stepped up more than 1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. And by American Public Media, announcing Krista Tippett's new book, Einstein's God, Conversations about Science and the Human Spirit, available in bookstores now. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to updates on the economy and business, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at the events for Friday. For the first time since the earthquake, American Airlines will resume service to and from Haiti. The federal government will release data for retail sales in February. And Friday is the 40th birthday of author, publisher, and literacy advocate Dave Eggers. I'm Kevin Ferguson.
The This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and I have this economic indicator for you to try to wrap your brain around. The Treasury Department announced yesterday that the federal budget deficit for February was almost $221 billion. That's February, a single month. It is bigger than the yearly budget gap was not all that long ago. There are, of course, wars to pay for, the stimulus package and the bailouts as well. But commentator Todd Buchholz says we ought to be paying attention to something else, too.
What's the toughest job in Washington this year? Toyota's customer relations phone operator? John Edwards' outplacement counselor? No. The toughest job is talking about Social Security and Medicare without either scaring people or watching their eyes glaze over. Though this is radio, I can almost see your pupils retreating back into your head. Yet, with the budget exploding, it's the real moose in the room. When President Franklin Roosevelt set the Social Security retirement age at 65, the average 65-year-old was dead. Life expectancy was less than 65. That's why the numbers worked. But now we're living longer. No one would be so heartless or stupid to walk up to a 65-year-old woman at her retirement party and say, "Guess what, Aunt Harriet? We know you've been counting on Social Security, but we've decided to reform. You're on your own." Likewise, would anyone be so stupid to go up to 12-year-old Jake, who just finished his paper route, and say, "Jake, we know you've been counting on Social Security all your working life, so it would be cruel to change Social Security and Medicare since you're so dependent on them." The kid has 60, 70 years to get ready. Americans must decide at what age people have enough time to save for their own retirement. I know the answer is not 65, but I also know the answer is not 12 either. We just need to agree. Then young workers can make regular deposits to buy an annuity that will cover future medical care and living expenses. If we steady our rocky federal finances, the government can match those contributions. Personal accounts will come someday. The only question is whether we wait till the whole country looks like a crowded pawn shop and we're just rolling the dice like Nathan Detroit trying to get lucky.
Todd Buchholz was an economic advisor to the first President Bush. His latest book is called New Ideas from Dead CEOs. Your hopefully lively ideas come to us best via our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Video gamers the world over are going to recognize this. That is the sound of an Xbox 360 console waking up, a sound, or a tune, I suppose you could call it, that was composed specifically for the Xbox by a professional musician. The music gets even more complicated once you load up a game disc. Composers spend days or even weeks, sometimes, scoring the more complicated games. Michael Sweet writes some of that music. He also teaches aspiring game composers how to do it at the Berklee College of Music in Boston.
The field of video games has been around for quite a number of years, but the sort of the exploration into sort of modern genres of music and the ability for us to use orchestral music and things like that inside of video games is relatively new, I think. And it's because of video game budgets sort of slowly increasing over time, as well as this sort of technology being able to broaden the scope of what music can do in a video game.
When you sit down to write for a video game, is it pretty much the same process as writing for a television show or a movie or something?
In linear media, as in film, we try and tell the story of what's going on screen. But there's a significant difference when you get to video games where you're still trying to tell the story, but the player's actually in control of how the story's playing out. It's basically you set up a rule set for the music.
By rule, you mean if he shoots this guy, then the music sounds like this, and if the car crashes this way, it sounds like this?
Absolutely. It's basically you set up a rule set for the music where if an event happens, then it triggers this piece of music. If the boss monster comes out at the end of the level, you want the tension to rise up and the music to change in conjunction with those actions.
All right, so I want to play a piece of music that you actually scored for a video game called Supremacy. Let's roll that. And right there, the hero's doing something dramatic, probably, right?
That's a fairly sort of dramatic score with a lot of tension, and it has a little bit of science fiction in it. So yeah, when you're writing it, you actually end up writing sort of many pieces of music that need to flow from one to another. And so you actually can write a whole mess of transition pieces that take you from one, you know, from the low tension to the very exciting and dramatic action, and back to the exploration mode and things like that. And you tie all these pieces together, either by branching or layering elements together.
So let's play another piece of music. This one is a piece you sent along. It's from a game called Africa, and I want to listen to it here and then ask you a couple of questions. What makes that special? I mean, that could be, it sounds to me a little bit like the music from, what was that Angela Lansbury TV series from however long ago it was, right? It sounds a little bit like that. So what makes it good for you in video game terms?
I think that entire score, the game's called Africa, and it's a photojournalism game where you actually go to Africa and you go out on safari and you try and take interesting pictures of wildlife and animals out in the depths of Africa, and it's a really quite a beautiful game. The game itself was created with a 106-piece orchestra, this huge, massive orchestra, and I think that there are scores that have this sort of beautiful quality that bring you into the game and have this ability to move you from an emotional level, and I feel like this score really does that.
You know, I imagine it runs from things you can play on your iPhone to full-size video games, so the market for this kind of music, for the people who can write it, must be enormous.
The market is sort of exploding, and the dollar-to-dollar ratio between films and video games it has really become this gigantic entity where I think people are respecting video games at a whole new level. A typical video game, a really high AAA title, like Halo or something like that, costs millions and millions of dollars to make, but it also generates quite a bit of revenue on the other end of it as well.
Michael Sweet and the Art of Video Game Scoring at the Berklee College of Music in Boston, Massachusetts. Michael, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, continuing an occasional theme of mine, that what we have in the government's response to the financial crisis of late 2008 is a crisis wasted. That is, no real or substantive reform as of yet. Today's Exhibit A is Senator Christopher Dodd. The chairman of the Senate Banking Committee said today he is going to release his regulatory overhaul plan on Monday. His plan as in one without any Republican support at all. Maybe I'm wrong on this one, but isn't this whole thing starting to look a lot like the health care debate and how Senate Democrats pushed ahead with their own bill and where that got us? I don't know. Let me know. It's letters at marketplace.org. Tell me what you think. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 44 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ added 9 points, also 0.4%. The S&P 500 bumped up 4 points, 0.3%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor of the program is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on The Big Show, why scandal doesn't play so well in the Chinese economy.
Officials really take excessive measures to try to keep the appearance of stability.
That would be political stability. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.